Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Soshi talks with Sarah Peterson from the Rivers Institute at the University of Dayton. In Politics, Ohio, Attorney General Mike DeWine speaks with Ellen Belcher. We've got Bill Felker and Poor Will's Almanac, and we'll take you on another road trip with the new Ohio Guide. First, earlier this year, we told you the Teacher of the Year Award nominations were underway. Sponsored by Heroic Teacher Press and their partners, submissions for the honors came from all over the Midwest. Those winners have been selected, and a local teacher took one of the top spots. 30-year-old Nick DeGrazio is a math teacher at Northmont High School. He picked up the first runner-up spot, and I sat down with him to talk about the award and the teaching philosophy that helped him win the honor. We begin with what his inspiration was to become a teacher.
I always tell the story of when I was in high school, I had a really great math teacher and a really poor math teacher. And I never wanted a student to have an experience like I did with a poor math teacher, but I wanted every student to have the experience that I did with Mrs. Finney, my really good math teacher.
Tell me a little bit about your teaching philosophy. What do you try to put into your job each day?
Each day, I think my main goal is to connect with the students on a level that has nothing to really do with math, but more of a personal relationship level. My main goal is to build rapport with all my students and to really develop that relationship and work it into something that inspires them to work a little harder in my class. The math, I think, is really the easy part. So for me, when I can build that relationship with a kid and get to know them on a more personal level, they're willing to work a little harder for me. I understand their situation a little better, and that really inspires both of us to make the learning process a little easier.
You said you teach essentially high school kids. I think people tend to fear the next generation, that they're not going to work as hard. They're not going to live up to, you know, expectations that previous generations place on them. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. I think that if you look on it on a completely surface level, that you might get that impression from these kids. But if you dig a little deeper, you really understand that they care about themselves, they care about their friends, they care about their family, they care about their school. There's really a lot more to them than just, I think, what people see on the outside and maybe hanging around the malls or things like that. But on a personal level, they're good. They're willing to work hard for people who are willing to work hard for them, and they're willing to do what they need to do to succeed.
Tell me a little bit about what you do in the classroom. Anything kind of out of the ordinary?
Yeah. So in math, I think a lot of people just are used to the chalk talk and teachers standing up in front of the classroom. But one thing that I've started this year is I do show and tell every Friday. So every Friday I've had a student get up in front of the class and talk about just something in their life that they enjoy. Sometimes they bring in things to show. Other times they just talk about what they like. And then they need to talk about a goal that they have in life and what they are doing currently to achieve that goal. So that in itself is a little different and outside of the ordinary math range. Something else that I've been doing is I've been trying to really work a lot on atypical review games. So I bought a Nerf blaster and I've been using it in my classroom so students can, we put multiple choice problems up and they can select answers by using the gun, and that kind of engages them a little bit more.
That probably gets a good response.
Oh, it definitely does. But we have to be careful because it's not a gun. It's a blaster or a question or answer selector.
And so you're kind of doing things, I don't know, out of the box, out of the ordinary. And was that reflected in what the award committee gave as the reason for your selection?
I think that was part of the reason. And I think another part of the reason is I really try to be involved in as many things at school as I can, be it committees that just involve staff members or also trying to get involved with students and their activities after school. So going to sporting events, going to watch their musical performances, watch their plays or anything like that. And also one of the main things is I've been working with a program where we're trying to increase the student voice in the high school. So give students an opportunity to be heard. And I've been the leader of a team that's really pushing this program at the high school where we are asking students what they think about their education, what they think about their teachers, what they think about how they learn. And they were telling me that a driving force is probably my push to get other teachers to buy into this idea and buy into this concept to listen to the students a little more.
We talked about the fact that kids really care about their friends and families and the hard work that's expected of them and placed in front of them, but they're facing some tough challenges these days.
Oh, they are. And I think in any district that you go into, the challenges are always going to be different. And I think a lot of the challenges with the students is trying to kind of incorporate these issues that are facing them at home. Parents are losing their jobs, and students are having to work to help pay bills, which in some instances. Other instances, students are having to take care of their younger siblings. they're working more to pay for college. College is getting more expensive. So they got all those issues facing them aside from just the natural ideas and problems they face growing up in terms of finding out who they are as people.
Let's talk a little bit about the spirit of Northmont for people who aren't familiar with the school.
Sure. Northmont's a great school. It encompasses a few different cities. And back when it became Northmont, these cities were kind of all divided, but they've really grown around this idea and this concept of Northmont and Northmont City Schools. And even though the cities are still separate entities, all the members and community members can rally around this concept of Northmont and who we are as a school. We got a great football team, great sports programs, great marching band, and great arts programs. So the community can really get behind everything we are. And they recently just even approved a levy for us to build a new high school and a new preschool, kindergarten, first grade building.
So as first runner-up with Heroic Teacher Press Award, what does that mean for you?
For me, it means that I must be doing something right. I think teaching is the greatest profession in the world, and it's a very rewarding profession. And working with the kids is one of the greatest things that I've ever had the privilege of doing. It means that hard work has definitely paid off, and people are noticing that I'm working hard. But it also means that I've surrounded myself with a lot of good people, and I've had a lot of good mentors and former teachers, other administrators within the building and within the district, and just community members. And it really shows the support that people have for teachers at Northmont.
Any plans that you'd like to get going with kids but haven't been able to get started yet?
Right now, I'm really working on pushing students to be a part of all of our department meetings and all of our building meetings. So when we're making decisions as a staff, we are listening to what they have to say because there's no better ideas because it impacts their education the most.
Nick DeGrazio, Heroic Teacher Press Award. Congratulations and thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for talking to me.
Nick DeGrazio teaches at Northmont High School. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. In this week's road trip from the New Ohio Guide, we're headed for Akron. Like other Ohio cities, it's engaged in a never-ending effort to keep and attract businesses. But as producer Mark Uricki found out, it was the high ground that gave Akron and Summit County their names that also served to give the city its start.
Native Americans knew that the land where Akron now sits lay between two waterways, the Cuyahoga and the Tuscarawas Rivers. The Indians had established a portage path through the area to carry their canoes from one water route to the next. What they probably did not know is that they were crossing a continental divide. Jenny Vassarelli of the Cuyahoga Valley National Park.
Everything north of Akron, the rivers flow towards Lake Erie and ultimately out to the Atlantic Ocean. Everything south of Akron flows south to the Ohio River, Mississippi River, and Gulf of Mexico.
There's a spot in southern Akron near the Portage Lakes today where you may see water from the Ohio Canal split in two directions. The Ohio Canal brought prosperity to the city because area farmers had a way to ship their produce to markets back east to New York. But the canal brought another benefit. Akron's land has the steepest grade between Cleveland and Zor, and so the many boat locks were clustered in the city.
So the Ohio and Erie Canal actually had to get over that portage that we described, and that's what the cascade of locks in Akron is a staircase of locks that carry the canal up to the summit and then over.
And that meant passengers would stop and eat, sleep, or shop in the city. The canal also brought water streams that local millers like Ferdinand Schumacher could use for power. Schumacher's operation became the Quaker Oats Company. The head of the Ohio and Erie Canal Coalition, Dan Rice, notes that another industrialist was brought to Akron. The Board of Trade convinced Benjamin Franklin Goodrich to come from New York.
What he did is he basically established his operations right on the banks of the Ohio and Erie Canal in downtown Akron. That then grew up to be the B.F. Goodrich Rubber and Tire Company. And that then also then attracted other rubber and tire companies to actually come here to Akron, including the Goodyear Tire Rubber Company, General Tire, Mohawk, Cyberling Tire, and Firestone, obviously, as well. So many other industries were actually lured because of actually Dr. Benjamin Goodrich originally coming here.
Goodrich came before the automobile, so his company mostly made rubber boots and fire hose. But author David Giffels said he soon had company.
This was in the mid-1870s before the automobile industry had begun. And so by virtue of, you know, maybe foresight or maybe luck, The first sort of cornerstone of the tire industry landed here, and then, you know, at the turn of the century, Goodyear and Firestone followed, and then the auto industry took off, and there went Akron.
In the 1920s, Akron's population tripled, making it the fastest growing city in the country.
We very much mimicked the dot-com thing where, you know, this was like a version of the Silicon Valley where all these other companies would start up and try to catch on to this, you know, this suddenly booming industry that was the future. And most of them didn't make it. But, you know, but then the big ones really became like huge conglomerates, international conglomerates.
Today, most tire manufacturing occurs in southern states, but rubber and polymer research and development still goes on in Akron, and the Ohio Canal, which started it all, has been completely restored as a bike and hike trail through the city. In Akron, I'm Mark Uricki.
You can download the audio tour Industrial Ohio Steel and Rubber at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. This is WISO Weekend. So She Talks is a program designed to enlighten the world with knowledge from primarily institutions of higher education in Southwest Ohio. In today's edition, Sarah Peterson is a graduate assistant for the Rivers Institute at the University of Dayton. The Rivers Institute is housed in UD's FIT Center for Leadership and Community. They work to reunite Dayton with its rivers as central communal, economic, aesthetic, and ecological natural resources vital to the region. Students are also a vital part of that organization, and today Sarah Peterson talks about an experiential leadership curriculum that allows students to be engaged on campus and in the community. Here's an excerpt from her talk.
From the beginning, we embarked on a distinctive process to foster innovative student learning that could be readily available through UD's general education program to all University of Dayton students. As part of this process, the student design teams asked themselves, what if your education focused on what you should learn instead of focus on what you should be taught? What if you were able to develop a course that was bigger than just you? What if you could involve students and professors from all majors in your class projects? What if you could reach out to community members for their perspective as you develop curriculum? What if everything you are about to create impacted more than just your university? This sparked great excitement about the River Leadership Curriculum among river stewards, faculty, and community partners. The Rivers Institute focuses its learning on the rivers in Dayton because it's what we have, all disciplines can be applied to the study of it, and research on it is limitless. Other schools may have another common asset that they could focus on. The principles would remain the same in developing a curriculum like this. The River Leadership Curriculum is engaging, exciting, and gives students the opportunity to interact with professionals from all fields in the community. Rivers are a practical example when teaching about leadership skills, but any interdisciplinary topic could be used. The idea of the River Leadership Curriculum was discussed at a beneficial time when the University of Dayton was considering revising its undergraduate curriculum. It has acted as an example of a different approach which really allowed us to engage students in the community. The Rivers Institute took this opportunity to develop students into water resource leaders by teaching them about leadership skills. With the generous support of the McGregor Fund, the Rivers Institute was able to carry out the development of the River Leadership Curriculum. It was determined a backwards design approach would be most beneficial. With this design, we decided what we wanted the students to know and what we wanted them to be able to do by the time their experience in the course ended. From there, we determined what experiences, assignments, and lessons would best achieve those things. Part of this backwards design was creating student learning outcomes. This is how we defined what we wanted the students to know. The student learning outcomes we created are: after completing the River Leadership Curriculum, the student should be able to 1. Develop expertise in and articulate connections among scientific, sociological, aesthetic, and public policy perspectives of a river system. 2, explain how synthesizing scientific, sociological, aesthetic, and public policy perspectives of a river system enable them to understand its past, evaluate its present state, and envision its future. 3, develop a project proposal which calls on them to exercise leadership skills in a community or campus project that demonstrates their ability to synthesize and act upon scientific, sociological, aesthetic, and public policy perspectives of a river system. And 4, complete a course project that demonstrates their understanding of and ability to integrate scientific, sociological, aesthetic, and public policy perspectives of a river system. With the student learning outcomes defined, we planned the class sessions and assignments. A lot of this development occurred during the summer of 2010. 7 student interns were hired to lead the development. This was a creative summer where the group was able to dream about ideas for the curriculum. Each student led a team of faculty and community partners in developing a section of the course. The groups made sure the class was experiential with field trips, meetings with our community partners, and with students charting their development with journal writings and reflections. After hard work from the students and dedication from faculty and community partners, a course curriculum for the 2010-2011 academic year was formed. The fall 2010 pilot semester was comprised of 15 students from various majors, including business, communications, education, sociology, chemistry, biology, as well as others. The students participated in 5 field trips, including traveling to Sunwatch Indian Village and Hills and Dales Metro Park. The students also heard from 15 different guest speakers that included University of Dayton faculty from different departments, as well as community partners from organizations like Miami Conservancy District and the City of Dayton Department of Water. At the end of the fall semester, each student had proposed a project to be completed on campus or in the community. Also at the end of the semester, we asked all the students to write a final reflection on their journey through the class, as well as course evaluations. This feedback determined what changes needed to be made for the following academic year. The feedback from the students was positive and very constructive. The following semester, spring 2011, the proposed projects were put in motion. Each group was charged with creating a deliverable by the end of the course, as they worked closely with community partners, faculty members, and other students. By the end of the semester, there were 3 complete deliverables. One group created curriculum for the summer program at Adventure Central, focused on teaching kids about our rivers and fostering a sense of place in Dayton. The curriculum was implemented successfully the following summer. Another group worked on implementing low-impact development techniques on UD's campus, and the last group worked with the Dayton Development Coalition's H2 Open for Business campaign and their marketing efforts. One student was able to secure an internship from her work on the project, and 2 other students in the class have begun working in the Dayton area since graduating. All of the students had a unique experience in the class. One student wrote in a final class reflection, "The River Leadership course has been one of the most interesting classes I have taken at UD. It was such an interesting course because the material interacted directly with applicable issues surrounding Dayton, the Dayton region, and watersheds around the world." Another student commented on completing the group project during the spring 2011 semester, writing that they had gained a lot of beneficial experience in their group work. They mentioned their lack of experience with group work before, but saw the assets that each group member was bringing to the project. This student recognized the different backgrounds of the group members, as each had a different major, year in school, and hometown. This student praised these differences and saw how they contributed to learning leadership skills. A third student commented on the skills he developed during the spring 2011 semester. As they recognized the challenges with the project, but also the ways the group excelled. This student admitted they were unfamiliar with the education discipline which the group was working within. The student recognized this as a challenge they overcame in order to meet the needs of the community partner they were working with. The student also saw how working with a group and community partner would benefit them in their future career paths. Our second summer of development was the summer of 2011. We took this time to evaluate the two semesters of the RLC. We welcomed two new interns to the team, and they worked on making changes to the curriculum based on student feedback. This past semester, fall 2011, those changes were implemented, and we were able to see their value. We now have even more feedback from new students on the value of the course. All students involved, from the development to the implementation to participation in the course, have taken on leadership roles as they defined problems around rivers, investigated those problems, and found solutions. We continue to evaluate the curriculum and consider changes for the future. We also hope to share our model with other schools. We have found several elements to be necessary for the curriculum's success. They include engaging a diverse community of learners, including students, faculty, and community partners in all steps of the project. Identifying a common asset or interest, which you can build interdisciplinary curriculum around. Brainstorming all the possibilities when planning the student learning outcomes. Developing the curriculum through a creative summer process. Implementing and synthesizing the different disciplines. And always involving students. I hope you have enjoyed this short talk. If you would like more information on the River Leadership Curriculum and the Rivers Institute, please visit rivers.udayton.edu. Thanks for listening.
Sarah Peterson with the Rivers Institute at the University of Dayton on Soshi Talks. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. I'm talking with Mike DeWine, Ohio's Attorney General and a Republican from Cedarville in Greene County. Thanks for your time, Attorney General.
Ellen, good to be with you. Thank you very much.
Recently, you announced that you're giving $75 million to Ohio's 88 counties to tear down abandoned homes that have been foreclosed on. Experts say that Ohio has tens of thousands of homes that need to be razed because they're in such bad shape that they'll never sell. This $75 million comes from a nationwide settlement with five mortgage lenders who were accused of defrauding borrowers. In a nutshell, the lenders were using forged or incomplete paperwork to foreclose on homeowners quickly. Montgomery County is eligible for more than $4 million of the grant money. Greene County is eligible for over $700,000. Clark could tap almost $1 million. What do the counties have to do to qualify for this money?
Let me kind of set the stage for this. This was part of the robo-settlement, and every state got a certain amount of money, and then it was up to the state how to actually spend that money. I got to make the decision in Ohio and decided that a big portion of that I thought should be spent on dealing with a problem that I have seen around the state, and that is the problem of abandoned homes. And you can go into virtually every city in this state and many smaller communities and see these homes that are just literally falling apart, and it really creates a huge problem for the neighborhood.
So what do the counties have to do to qualify? What are the criteria that you're putting down for them?
What the counties have to do is to submit to the Attorney General's office an application, and we've tried to make it a very simple application, and we just want to be assured that this money is going to be used for the demolition of homes. We've asked that only one application be submitted per county because we want everybody at the local level to work together.
Montgomery County had almost 31,000 vacant residential properties in 2010. If it ends up getting $4 million, which is what it's eligible for, how big of a dent in the problem will that make? I guess what I'm asking is, how much does it cost to tear down a house?
It costs anywhere between $4,000 to $12,000, $13,000. It depends on the location, depends on the size of the home, depends on the construction material. You can see that with $75 million spread around the state, it is not going to take care of all the problem because it's going to take a lot more resources.
Under the settlement, five lenders agreed to pay a total of $25 billion for their fraudulent loan practices. Ohio got $335 million of that. What's going to happen to the other $260 million that is not being used to tear down properties?
Well, we have an additional $20 million, which we got in the Attorney General's office. So we got roughly $95 million. We're going to take that other $20 million and allow groups, nonprofit groups, to apply for that money. And the whole idea will be that this money will be used to help the victims again. Some of that money will, in all likelihood, go to legal aid that will help people who have a mortgage problem with some of the options that they have today under the law, but frankly, they many times need a lawyer. The rest of the money is not going to flow through our office. The rest of the money is going to go out directly from the banks that signed this agreement, the five banks that signed the agreement. And there's a formula, and the banks are to be contacting the victims. And these are people who lost their homes in this foreclosure crisis. They may be also people who are underwater, who still are hanging in there, but the value of their home is less than their outstanding mortgage. And that money will, again, come from these banks, and that should be happening shortly.
The settlement did not preclude individual borrowers or investors who bought the toxic mortgages, or even states' attorneys general for filing lawsuits down the road. What other, if any, action are you going to be part of to recoup the losses that people experienced?
There are other banks that were not part of this settlement, and the attorney generals are working together to go after these banks. So it is certainly possible that we will be able to reach agreement with the other banks that were involved in this mortgage crisis, and we would have a second round of money and a second group of individuals that could be helped.
I've been talking with Mike DeWine, Ohio's Attorney General. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Ellen.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of late spring. In the middle of this past January, I set 25 geranium seeds in a flat of moist potting soil and placed them under a grow light in the attic. 18 sprouts appeared in 10 days and grew steadily throughout the coldest time of the year. Although I have always had a weakness for new sprouts and spring growth, something about these geraniums was different. Maybe it was their location in the attic, that they gave life to a cluttered and neglected place of objects that had lost their relevance. No matter the reason, my reaction to the plants surprised me a little. Whenever I went up to the attic to check on them, I felt happy. I felt especially at home with them. I felt their benign and comforting energy. I felt supremely useful watering and feeding them. Now, I once corresponded with a naturalist who believed that plants could actually talk to her, but she was reluctant to tell me what they said. And I'm also reluctant to articulate the message of the sprouts in my attic. Maybe the closest I can come is to say that they were companion plantings. That these minute life forms were communicating with me seemed unlikely, but obvious at the same time. Clearly I was affected by them, either because of my own late winter state of mind or because of their unusual beauty, or because of their utter stillness with which they were telling me about themselves and about myself. In response, I reached out to them in the attic cloister, drawing from them the power I no longer possessed. My anxieties were lifted, my fears taken away. I became part of their secret life, and they a part of mine. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of early summer. In the meantime, plant some seeds. find the secret life.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up next, The Book Nook.